Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. We begin today's show by discussing immigration. On Monday, Donald Trump issued a threat via Twitter, saying that next week ICE will begin the process of removing millions of undocumented people in the United States. Immigration attorneys say ICE is not capable of carrying out such a large-scale deportation operation. But this latest threat has invoked fear in immigrant communities. The Washington Post reports that parents are vowing to keep their children out of summer programs, shopping trips are consolidated to limit driving, and migrants without papers are avoiding large crowds and minimizing going out at night and even attending church. And then meantime, the Associated Press is reporting on mistreatment and neglect at a detention facility in El Paso, Texas. The AP reports that a 2-year-old boy locked in detention wants to be held all the time. A few girls ages 10 to 15 say they've been doing their best to feed and soothe the toddler who was handed to them by a guard days ago. Lawyers are warning that kids are taking care of kids. There's inadequate food, inadequate water and sanitation for 250 infants, children, and teens at the Border Patrol Station. And then on Tuesday, Sarah Fabian, a lawyer with the Department of Justice, told a 3-judge panel in San Francisco that the United States government is not required to provide migrant children in custody with soap, toothbrushes, or adequate bedding. The Trump administration is appealing a 2017 district court ruling, that found the U.S. government violated a decree that guarantees basic rights for children detained at the border. So there's a lot going on just this week. Joining us to talk about coverage of these issues is Cindy Carcamo, a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, focusing on immigration. Hi, Cindy. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you. I know, Cindy, I was following your Twitter that you've tweeted about all of these issues this week. And since you are an immigration reporter with the Los Angeles Times, you wrote a very lengthy story last August, which we have on our website, called In Mountains of Guatemala, Searching for Parents Deported from U.S. Without Children. I want to ask you just a general question. We always start the show talking about journalism that really stood out this week. So when it comes to these crucial issues, where are you seeing good reporting? What stands out for you?
Well, for me, I think what stands out for me are the stories. Let's maybe take a step back. I think a lot of immigration reporters are just at this point kind of reacting to what is happening, because there's just so much coming down the pipeline. And we saw that also last summer. I mean, it was just a struggle to keep up and to cover all of this. And I think that really the stories that resonate with me and the stories that I try to do as much as I can are the stories that take a step back. And you're able to basically say, or to think, okay, why is it that we're here right now in this moment of time? And, you know, how is it that we got to this point? And really, what is happening that is pulling people or pushing people to make these treacherous journeys, right? And what are the ramifications for these countries as well? So for me, the stories that really resonate are the stories that do these deep dives, that really give kind of the humanity behind what is happening in regards to immigration policy. And the stories, for instance, you mentioned it in your opening with the AP of the older children trying to soothe the toddler. I mean, it's those, scenes that really, I think, bring it home to people. And that's why when I did my story last year in August, I really wanted to do that story to be able to see what it really is like to look for people who have been deported without their children. To me, that's the important journalism. I think it's hard, though, because there's just so much coming at us right now that really it is kind of a luxury to take a step back and to be able to do the stories and give full context and perspective really those deep dives that give like the humanity behind what is happening under these complex immigration policies.
Exactly. And it's hard to also tell that story, even if you have 5 or 10 minutes. So luckily, we have about 30 minutes with you, so we can really take a deep dive. So I want to ask you, since you did that piece last year and you briefly talked about just the importance of looking at why so many people are still leaving Central America. I mean, we've had on a lot of people, and of course, everyone has a different story. There are a lot of reasons, whether it's poverty, domestic violence, climate change, gang. I mean, there's so much. And so what are you hearing right now? You actually retweeted a tweet from Jonathan Blitzer, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and he wrote, "It may be obvious at this point, but it still can't be said enough. Trump's constant threats of sweeping action at the border play right into the sales pitch of smugglers in the region. Go to the U.S. now before it's too late." What are you hearing from people who are still leaving Central America, knowing that they might be separated from their families?
I think what I'm hearing is a lot of what I was hearing last summer when everything, you know, was breaking and the news was coming down. I think there's this utter feeling of desperation where people, and I think that's why I retweeted that what Blitzer said was that, you know, you have this feeling of desperation and this feeling of, if I don't do this now, I'm going to lose my chance. And things are so bad for me right now where I am that this might be my only opportunity. And I think that the unintentional consequences of Trump's rhetoric, of everything that's coming down the pipeline, is that the people who are getting that message are seeing it in a different way, and it's unintended. You know, they're seeing it as, okay, I better go now because this might be my only opportunity. And in regards to the factors that drive people to make this journey with their kids, I mean, I think a lot of it is just a variety of reasons. I mean, it's hard because not all of them are asylum seekers. Or some of them think they're asylum seekers and really they probably wouldn't qualify. I remember I spoke with one woman in Tijuana a couple of months ago, actually, who told me that, things are really bad. I'm running out of money. I'm a single mother. I'm really poor. And so I'm coming because I want to seek asylum. And I asked her, and I kind of pressed her a little bit, and I said, well, what is it that's, you know, is there something that's happening in country? Or do you feel like you're under threat? And she's like, no, I just want a better life. And I think that there's also, and I think that's one thing that isn't covered, is that there's this misunderstanding sometimes in these communities that, you know, if you're poor, that will allow you to qualify for asylum. And so you have cases like that. And then you have cases also where people really are fleeing a threat. You know, women who are fleeing their batters, who are waiting in Tijuana, who are afraid that their batters are going to even follow them to Tijuana. And they're waiting for their turn to ask for asylum at a proper port of entry there in San Ysidro. So really, it's a mix of cases and also in a mix of reasons. And you have people where it's not just one reason, you know. It's not just poverty. It's not just a threat that they got because they weren't paying the extortion fee to the local gang. It's a mix of things. And I think that's why it's kind of hard, I think, maybe sometimes for journalists to tell the story because you have so many different stories. Not one case is the same as another. And I think that's one of the things that we're trying to grapple with as well. We have to make it clear that it's not all people who are seeking asylum, and that they're not all asylum seekers. Some people say to me, no, I'm just coming here because I want a better life, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you have, it's like all over the place. But there's no denying, though, that in these countries, especially in particular like El Salvador and Honduras, people are fleeing really, really dangerous situations where whole neighborhoods have been, you know, evacuated. You know, people have left because there's a, you know, there's this neighborhood that's controlled by a certain gang. So, I mean, I think that is a struggle as journalists to be able to tell these stories. You know, we have to kind of, I think, really get down to the micro, but that's not emblematic of everyone's story. You know what I mean?
Right. What about the numbers? The New York Times reports that more than 144,000 migrants were taken into custody at the border just last month. This is the highest monthly total in 13 years. So what does that say to you?
That says to me that people are desperate, and they're seeing the rhetoric, and they're hearing the rhetoric that's coming from the White House, and they're thinking, okay, this is our chance to go. But also, I think those numbers, we have to really put those numbers into perspective too, because I think that sometimes the American people, they see, oh, 144,000, oh my gosh, all of these people are trying to come in illegally. And actually, that's not, you know, a good percentage of those people are people who are, so they're all apprehended, obviously, right? But a good portion of those people are not people who are trying to enter the country illegally, clandestinely, and sneak through. It's a very different dynamic now. Most of those people are giving themselves up to Border Patrol officials and saying, I need help. I want asylum. So I think that we have to also put it in that context, that it's a very different kind of immigration or migration that was happening, like, let's say, 10 years ago, where it's not people who are trying to sneak in clandestinely. It's people who are giving themselves up to Border Patrol officials.
What happens after these people are apprehended?
Well, they're processed. They're taken in. If we're talking about asylum seekers specifically, usually what happens is they see an asylum officer, and if they have credible fear, that officer determines whether that person has a credible fear of returning to their country. The bar for that is pretty low. Most people meet that, although I've been hearing reports that it's become increasingly difficult to meet that bar. But I think that might be changing because the administration has made it a lot more difficult to gain asylum, obviously, with everything that happened last summer with Sessions' new policies and everything. And so what happens is they're processed, but, if they are determined to have credible fear, then really it depends. Some people are being let go. I know that that's happening a lot here along California and San Diego, and they're being let go without monitors, ankle monitors. Some people do have ankle monitors. I mean, it really depends, but I think that what we have to keep in mind is that, you know, when you're hearing about people being detained in these facilities were meant for a different kind of population. And so if you're detained, you know, these facilities were basically, the infrastructure was made or intended for adult, mostly males. It was a different population that we're talking about, right? They were trying to address the situation that was happening like years ago when it was mostly adult males who were making the trek to the U.S. border. So really, these facilities are not adequate. They're not appropriate for mothers, for women, and especially children. And so really what you're dealing with, the crisis that we're talking about, is that the United States does not have the infrastructure to hold this kind of population, to hold children, to hold families. And we're seeing the repercussions of that. I mean, we're seeing deaths, and we're seeing people who are very sick. You know, what the AP described, really bad situations, dire situations. So I think that is the crisis, is that the infrastructure that the United States has to hold people is not appropriate, is not adequate, and it's supposed to be temporary, but people are staying for much more than just temporary.
Today, it's our media roundtable, and we're joined by Cindy Carcamo. She's an immigration reporter with the Los Angeles Times, and we're talking about media coverage of immigration. We're going to talk about these Twitter threats that Donald Trump put out on Monday, which has really invoked fear in immigrant communities. We're talking also about what is happening in these detention centers. And if you have any questions or comments, what really stands out to you about this kind of coverage? I just feel like every couple of weeks we get a new report, whether it's from Reveal or the New York Times or this time the AP, the LA Times, about these horrific conditions in these facilities. And these reports come out, and of course, activists are doing what they can. Lawyers are filing lawsuits. But what is really changing as a result of this? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What really strikes you about media coverage? And if anything stands out for you, if you heard a story or read a story that we should know about, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So to that point, Cindy, you know, like I said, I feel like these explosive, horrific reports come out every couple of weeks. This one from the AP, and this report was based on 60 interviews that a legal team did with children at a facility in El Paso, and right. Data was obtained by the AP showing that there were 3 infants in the station, all with teen moms, along with a 1-year-old, 2 2-year-olds, a 3-year-old, 15 have the flu, 10 more are quarantined. And in the piece, Holly Cooper, who directs UC Davis's Immigration Law Clinic, says, in my 22 years of doing visits with children in detention, I have never heard of this level of inhumanity. So we get quotes like that on a regular basis. But at the end of the day, what really changes for these children and these young families?
Yeah, and I think it's really up to the American people. I mean, when the zero tolerance policy, for instance, that went into effect last summer, there was an uproar. I'm not really seeing that this time. And to me, I think also the story that will come, I think also we should also focus on what happened afterward also. I mean, obviously, I mean, this is really concerning. What's happening now, but also, like, you know, what happens to that child who gets ultimately, I mean, if they ultimately get released, like, what are the ramifications for that, you know, the mental ramifications, for a child to be in those conditions? And I think the follow-up to that will be just as important, if not more important, because these are young children and they're not able to process things like adults can, and I think it's going to have lasting effects on them. And I mean, I saw when I was in Guatemala last summer, I did that piece that you mentioned in regards to a team of lawyers and just civil society that were on the ground in Guatemala looking for the deported parents without their children, and their children were still in the U.S. And then I did a follow-up story later that took me back to Guatemala because there was going to be a reunification happening between one of the moms who's, like, at the end of the story, she's still waiting for her child. And I went to that. And she, and the story, I mean, I could send it to you too, but the story basically was about how she didn't recognize her child. Her child was 12 years old, and she said that he was a changed person. He had been detained for months, I think it was about 6 months now, at the time when she finally reunited with her. And she said that he wasn't the same boy. And then we looked at, and then she said to me, that he was put on medication without her consent, by the way. This is at a facility in Chicago. And so she was looking through his stuff, and in between, there was like coloring books and Play-Doh, and then there were these prescription, canisters. And, for heavy, heavy drugs, I mean, these are antipsychotics that her child was put on without her consent, she says. And they didn't know. I mean, these are people who are in situations where they don't have much money. Some of them don't have, a lot of them don't have much education. They don't know, like, what these I mean, they might have some kind of idea what these drugs are, but, you know, there was a debate between the mom and the dad. The dad wanted to take the child off the drugs right away, and the mom was like, well, I don't know if that's safe, and, you know, and they had no help at all. I mean, really, I mean, they have very low resources. They don't have much resources when in the way of mental health services there for people, their population. And I kind of left the story like that, where they're debating, you know, whether they should take off their child immediately, like cold turkey off of these antipsychotics, which can be really dangerous. And so, I mean, that just kind of goes to show that the story doesn't end when they're released, if they're released. The story continues. And, right. You know, and there isn't much help, especially if you're the child's return to Guatemala. I mean, I tried to follow up. I kind of lost track of them, unfortunately. But I wanted to know what had happened to him and whether they had taken him off those drugs. So I think that those stories are important. Right now, you know, obviously you have this kind of like media frenzy, obviously, you know, where, you know, all of this is happening and you're reacting and you're covering this. But I think it's important to follow up and to see what happens afterward, because I think that that's when a lot of the really, really concerning things occur.
It's so incredibly important. Cindy Carcamo is an immigration reporter at the LA Times, and you can find the piece that she wrote in Mountains of Guatemala, Searching for Parents Deported from U.S. Without Children. I mean, what you bring up is so important, Cindy, to follow up on what happens when in this AP report we learn that these kids are going weeks without bathing or even having a clean change of clothes. And now we are learning that this lawyer for the DOJ, Sarah Fabian, told a three-judge panel in San Francisco just on Tuesday that the U.S. government is not required to provide children in custody with basic necessities, soap, toothbrushes, or adequate bedding.
Right.
I mean, this just came out. So we're talking about providing these kids with just basic necessities.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's where we are right now. I think that's why it's important also to kind of, like I said earlier, to take a step back as a reporter and to really look at the whole picture and try to see how it is that we got to this point. Right. Where this is being argued, where you have the DOJ attorney making that case, and I think we have to go back to previous administrations. We have to see how it is that we got to this point in regards to families being separated or families being detained or children being detained. I mean, this goes back a long time. You know, children were detained under the Obama administration. You know, really, this kind of like heightened, like, you know, the building, the construction of this deportation machine, of this incarceration machine, of detention, really, goes back several decades. And I think that that's how it is that, you know, it was basically set up for Trump to just put it on, you know, fast mode. And right. and that's why we're in the situation that we are now. And I think that that's when we have to do those stories that give that kind of perspective and give that history, that these things don't happen in a vacuum. This, I mean, I would say that this was, I mean, I don't want to be cynical about it, but it was a long time coming, you know,
right.
For some
right.
way.
We've done,
to be, yeah.
Yeah, we've done shows about how the Obama administration really laid the groundwork and then the Trump administration just took it all to a different level. And the last question I have for you as we're wrapping up, how do you think the media are going to cover this in the next year? Because Donald Trump, 25,000 people came to his reelection kickoff in Orlando last week, and we know what we're going to get from him. I mean, he started his campaign with very racist remarks about Mexicans, and here he is again, you know, talking about mass migration, bringing in millions of low-wage workers to take your jobs. He's talking about MS-13 and ICE. I mean, I saw people outside of the rally flashing those white power signs. So he says in a tweet, you know, we're going to deport millions of people. And then he kicks off his campaign with all of this racist rhetoric. And then we have these real issues of children being separated and not having basic necessities. this is what we're going to get for the next year and a half. What are your thoughts about how the media should cover this when he throws out this dangerous rhetoric?
Well, I think we need to do in the media is to, like I said, is to give that perspective and to give the history behind this, right? How we got to this point. Also, I really do think fact checking is very important. One point that I do want to point out, that I want to, you know, basically like the fact checks, just to clarify, where, you know, we're clarifying that things are, you know, the falsehoods that he's spewing, right? But one thing that I think is really important is that to keep in mind is that, you know, he doesn't have to deport millions of people in regards to his message being effective to his base. I think that, you know, and I'm in the midst of writing something about this right now, but really the rhetoric is almost enough. And it's enough to accomplish two different things, right? To basically let his base know that I'm with you, you know, and gives the base hope, really, a hope that they haven't had for quite some time in regards to immigration. And then the second thing it does is it spreads fear. It spreads fear among immigrants, among people who are in the country without legal status, but I would say it also spreads fear among even people who are in the country who are naturalized U.S. citizens. Right. And because nothing is really for certain anymore, it seems like anyone's kind of fair game in regards to deportations. I mean, I think there's this misconception that if someone's here in the country legally and they're a legal resident, that they're not going to be deported, and that's not the case anymore at all. I mean, it hasn't been for a while, but even more so now under this administration. And so I think that the rhetoric, and I was talking with some experts about this, is that the rhetoric is almost enough to make it seem like he's doing something, even if maybe at the end of the day, what we see next week won't be, I doubt it will be millions. I doubt it'll be thousands. It'll probably be hundreds if something happens. But aside from the numbers, I think that just his rhetoric is enough to accomplish what he wants, to instill enough fear where people will think twice about staying in the U.S. and maybe even self-deporting. I mean, that's happened before. And maybe enough to, like, not complain so much, not hit the streets and protest. So I think that his rhetoric is, if you look at it, it's very impactful. And really, at the end of the day, he doesn't really have to do what he says he's going to do, because I think his words are enough.
A Honduran woman who spoke on the condition of anonymity told the Washington Post that she's been hunkering down in her stuffy apartment since he made this announcement. She says it feels like we're prisoners. I mean, the Post quoted so many people who say, we're not going to church, we're not sending our kids to camp because we're so afraid.
Yeah, and I think it also, depends on where you're living, where you live, right? I mean, I think if you're somewhere in the South in a state that's not very immigrant friendly, you're likely more at risk than you are, like, let's say in Los Angeles. I think that in LA, the people that we've spoken with have kind of said something a little different. You know, obviously you have a whole range of people, but some of the people that we've spoken with have said, well, you know, there's only so much I can do. I have to go to work. I have to live my daily life. You know, my kids have to go to school or camp or whatever. And so I'm going to keep it in mind, and I'll be more, you know, I'll take more caution, but I'm still going to live my life. I mean, I think one thing that we have to realize is that, you know, immigrants are a resilient bunch. It takes a lot to be able to leave everything you know and sometimes make these treacherous trips to get here. And so, you know, I think that it's a group that just, you know, they're survivors. They know how to navigate difficult situations. So I think there definitely are people who are hunkering down and waiting for it to kind of, you know, pass through. But I think there are also people who are living their, like, daily lives and doing what they need to do to get food on the table, you know. So, and I think a lot of it also has to do with where you live and how friendly, immigrant-friendly the state is that you're living in.
Well, Cindy, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your reporting, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cindy Carcamo is an immigration reporter with the Los Angeles Times, and you can find her reporting at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and coming up after a quick break, we'll be joined by independent journalist David Daley to talk about gerrymandering and the possible citizenship question on the U.S. Census. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on today's program. On the phone, by sending an email to yourcall@kalw.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. And a reminder that all of your calls broadcasts are archived at our website, kalw.org. Coming up at 11, a further wrap-up of the week's news on 1A. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about media coverage of gerrymandering, the U.S. Census, and Thomas Hoffler, a man the New York Times describes as the architect of partisan political maps that cemented the Republican Party's dominance across the country. As today's guest David Daley reports, Hoffler preached secrecy. He writes, quote, "As a veteran Republican strategist traveled the nation teaching state legislators and other operatives how to gerrymander state legislative and congressional maps that favored their side, he cautioned against leaving any digital trail that could later haunt the GP in court," end quote. Well, it turns out that Hoffler accidentally left behind his own smoking gun from the grave. Hoffler died last August, and as his daughter searched various computers and thumb drives for family photos, she discovered a treasure trove of documents related to redistricting and the 2020 census. And recognizing their importance to several cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, she turned them over to Common Cause. Joining us to talk about this and media coverage of this is David Daley, Senior Fellow of Fair Vote, a nonpartisan champion of reform that actually gives voters greater choice and a stronger voice. He's also author of the must-read book, Rat Effed, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. He's former editor-in-chief of Salon, and his forthcoming book is Unrigged, How Americans Fought Back, Slayed the Gerrymander, and Reinvented Democracy. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks again, Russ.
Well, David, I'm so glad we have you on because I feel like Hoffler has just disappeared from the media. I mean, these thumb drives, the information was such a smoking gun. It gives us all of the evidence that we need to look at the just what the Republicans had in their plans. It's all right there for us to see. So first off, tell us what else we need to know about Thomas Hoffler and what he did for gerrymandering and the Republican Party.
Wow. Thomas Hoffler is one of the most amazing figures of the last 35 or 40 years, and yet we know almost nothing about him. Perhaps no one in Republican political circles did more to change the face of the country or to create this current America we live in, which is in so many places across the country, Democrats have more votes, Republicans have more seats. And this a kind of anti-majoritarianism was the kind of work that Thomas Hoffler did his entire life. He was perhaps first to understand the essential connection between voter data, powerful new computers, and the ability to draw congressional maps and state legislative maps that enhanced the power of his side. And he was the kind of political thinker who was always able to look around the corner and see the next opportunity to give his side a leg up. So in the 1980s and in the 1990s, it's Hoffler who works with African-American groups in the South, essentially in order to create additional majority-minority seats for black voters in states like North Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia. But Hoffler knows that by doing that, he will be creating all of these new conservative white districts across the South, and it's Hoffler who essentially flips the South red. In the 2010s cycle, it's Hoffler who comes up in many ways with the Republican strategy called Red Map, which is a redistricting majority project. It's the path that Republicans used as their road back to power after Barack Obama and the Democratic sweep in 2008. And essentially it involved focusing on state legislative districts in swing seats around the country, going after control of state legislative chambers in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, competitive states like that, dominating every seat at the table when it comes to a redistricting after the 2010 census, and then drawing maps that Democrats have not been able to make any inroads on this entire decade. And here we are in 2019. And that gets us up to the treasure trove of documents we just found.
Well, we'll talk about the documents and his connections to the U.S. Census in a minute, but I just want to go back in time because I think it's really important. Yeah. At a time when the media constantly tell us that we are a divided country, that Washington is broken, I think that these statistics need to be repeated, especially when we're talking about gerrymandering. As you said, the Democrats in 2010 through 2014 got so many more votes. In fact, here's a headline from Vice. The Senate's 46 Democrats got 20 million more votes than 54 Republicans across the 2010, 2012, and 2014 elections. But the Republicans got more seats because of gerrymandering. So, David, can you just remind us, give us a quick 101 on gerrymandering, how it works and why it's been, I mean, we talked about how Democrats have used it before in places like Chicago and New Jersey, but the Republicans by far, they use it, they dominate when it comes to gerrymandering.
I think that's right. Gerrymandering essentially is the art and the science of drawing district lines that enhance your own party's political power and that disadvantage the other side. You disadvantage the other side in two ways, and that's by either packing or cracking. You either pack them into as few districts as possible that the other side wins overwhelmingly, and you take all of the surrounding seats, or you crack them and you dilute their votes and kind of spread them across a whole bunch of districts that they can't win. Both of these are very, very effective. So I wrote this book because I didn't understand what happened in 2012 when the country re-elects Barack Obama president. Democrats hold the U.S. Senate. And Democrats also get 1.4 million more votes nationally for the House of Representatives. Republicans hold the chamber 234-201. And I was editor of Salon, and we were covering every day, you know, the government shutdowns and, you know, 50 different votes to repeal Obamacare and the lack of action on gun control, even after a massacre of kindergarten kids at Sandy Hook in Connecticut. And it just didn't make any sense to me. And I went back and started looking at some of these state delegations. And I was like, okay, how is it possible that a state like Pennsylvania sends 18 people to Congress and it's 13 Republicans and 5 Democrats? Pennsylvania, you know, is largely a blue state. It's a competitive state, but it's, you know, certainly not 71% Republican, as its congressional delegation was. Ohio, another 50-50 state, sends 12 Republicans and 4 Democrats. In Michigan in 2012, Democrats got almost 250,000 more votes, but they were packed and cracked so effectively that Republicans took 9 of the 14 seats anyway. You know, North Carolina has been 10-3 Republican almost this entire decade, and these are competitive swing seats. And it, it you know, it it pushes our politics into a really extreme polarized place, because these districts elect a different kind of member. They elect someone who's more conservative, less interested in compromise and talking to the other side. And it's a member of Congress or a member of a legislature who is essentially so insulated from the voters that it does not matter what people think. You know, the customary problem. In a democracy, if you violate the will of voters, you get voted out of office, right? But I mean, these legislators don't have to be worried about that, and they're free to be as extreme as they want to be. You see this in Georgia, Alabama, Ohio, lately, with these state bans on abortion. All of this coming in states in which a majority of citizens want to keep abortion legal, and yet Republican-controlled legislators in each of these states have passed some of the most extreme prohibitions that would outlaw it in almost all cases, and voters in these states can't do anything about it. This is what extreme toxic partisan gerrymandering does to our democracy.
When we look at who does it the most, we talked a little bit about Democrats doing it in Chicago and New Jersey. You tweeted that Democrats gerrymandered Maryland's 6th district. What percentage is done by Democrats, would you say, and what percentage is done by Republicans?
It's a really good question. I mean, politicians have gerrymandered as long as we've had politicians. You can trace this back all the way to, you know, Patrick Henry trying to screw James Madison out of a seat in our very first Congress, 240 years ago. But what people need to understand about gerrymandering is that it gets super turbocharged in 2010, thanks to all of these new computers, to these GIS mapping software that folks are able to draw lines with, and to all of the voter data that is available out there on all of us. It's more sophisticated, specific, precise, and faster than ever. I mean, all of these gerrymanders in the past that Democrats did, yes, Republicans did as well, but they were done, you know, on maps with magic markers or on really primitive computers. What happened in 2010 is different. And the party that had almost complete control of this process in 2010 was the Republicans. Thomas Hoffler, Chris Jankowski, a handful of really smart Republican strategists understood the potential of 2010 because it was a census year, because redistricting always follows a census year, so elections in 0 years mean more, that they can reverberate across an entire decade. And boy, this last time, have they ever. Republicans had the power to draw on their own 193 of the 435 U.S. House seats after 2010. Democrats had the power to draw on their own only 44. So wow. You need 218 for a majority. If you can draw 193 on your own, especially in these competitive swing states like North Carolina, Ohio, and others that we've talked about, gives you a pretty good edge towards getting there. I mean, if you look just at North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, those competitive states sent 49 Republicans and 20 Democrats to Congress in 2012, 2014, and in 2016. The Democrats did not flip a single seat in any of those states. That's 2.5 to 1.
So if you're talking 193 to 44, and David, I know that you closely follow how the media cover these issues. We hear partisan on a regular basis. Where are we hearing the truth about how gerrymandering is carried out? I mean, you were tweeting about Weekend Edition, and their headline was, "Is there any limit beyond which politicians can't go to entrench themselves in political power?" And you wrote, you know, Republicans gerrymandered Ohio, Michigan, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere, but sure, call it, quote, politicians.
Yeah, it's, you know, our establishment political media is locked in a both sides narrative that forces them to talk about how both sides do this. Well, you know, after 2010, they're right, both sides did it. Republicans did it in North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, Texas, Georgia, and Democrats did it in Maryland sixth. So the score is, you know, all of those states on one side, and Democrats won. So if you want to say both sides, you are ignoring the reality of what happened and which side did more of it. And frankly, I think you're also ignoring how this has played out over the course of this decade in all of these states, which is first that these lines have endured over the course of the entire decade. So in all of those states, not only in Congress, but also in state legislatures, Democrats often get more votes. Republicans often hold on to these insane supermajorities that they've been able to use to pass extreme legislation. But one of the things they've also done is pass extreme voting legislation that then enhances their ability to stay in power with fewer votes. So all of these voter ID bills, or, you know, cutting down on early voting or closing precincts in certain towns that just always seem to happen to be minority communities, you know, all of the tactics that we have seen throughout this decade, they tend to happen in these extremely gerrymandered states. This is the strategy. This is not an accident. This is part of the plan.
And this is also why the census is so important, because the census determines how political districts are drawn. And files on those drives that we talked about showed that Thomas Hoffler wrote a study in 2015 concluding that adding a citizenship question to the census would allow Republicans to draft even more extreme gerrymandered maps to stymie Democrats. What did we learn on those files specifically about that citizenship question and Hoffler's plan?
We need to think about the citizenship question differently than the media has been covering this question. The citizenship question is the next frontier of Republican gerrymandering, and this is what becomes clear when you look at the documents in Hoffler's hard drive. We right now, and I know we're running out of time, so I'll go as quickly as I can on something that's a little wonky and technical, but right now, districts in this country are drawn on the basis of total population, right? The idea is that representatives are supposed to represent everybody. So districts in a state have to be the same size. And total population means whether or not you are under 18, whether you are over 18, whether you are registered or not registered, whether or not you are a citizen. It's the total amount of people. And this is mandated in the Constitution for the drawing of congressional districts, and it is the standard practice for drawing of state legislative districts. What Hoffler sees in 2015 is that if Republicans are able to change that formula and to draw state legislative districts not on the basis of total population, but on citizen voting age population, that this would allow them to do more effective gerrymanders of state legislatures after 2020. And he does a study in Texas, and he sees what happens, and that it helps him to draw lines that essentially benefit white voters at the expense of Latino voters in these states. And he says this is the way to go, because Texas is slowly changing, right? I mean, in 2011, Texas – The state house is 101 Republicans, 49 Democrats. Right now, it's 83 Republicans, 67 Democrats. So it's not there yet, but by the middle of next decade, perhaps, if these trends continue, Texas could be a super competitive state. Not if we draw these districts on the basis of citizen voting age population. What that does is that would essentially eliminate from the count all of these children, all of these non-citizens, and you would have larger Democratic districts and fewer of them. These state legislatures would be able to do this as simple as passing a law that says we're going to district on the basis of citizen voting age population, and it could keep states like Texas, Arizona, Georgia, Florida, other large states with large immigrant populations, but also big conservative rural populations, it could shift the political power in all of those states for another decade or two to come and hold off the demographics of a changing America.
So in our final minute, David, what are your thoughts on media coverage of this? Because again, we now have the files. It's there for everyone to see. It's not a conspiracy theory. We talked earlier about how sometimes you feel like you're, you know, pushing these conspiracy theories because so many people in the media do not just call it like it is. The evidence is there. They can just read Hoffler's own words. So what are your thoughts on that? From gerrymandering to the census, we know the Republican end game. So why aren't we hearing more about that?
This is a crisis of democracy in many ways like no other we've faced in years. This is an effort to hold on to white political power in places where whites are not going to be in the majority any longer. And we need to begin really covering this as the threat to representative democracy that it is. We talk a lot about threats to a representative democracy coming from Facebook or coming from Russia. If this was actually a horror film, though, you know, the call is coming from inside the House. The threats to our democracy is coming from within our own political system. What the Republican Party is doing right now, this is part of a specific, coordinated, long-term strategy to hold on to white political power and to hold back the demographics of a changing nation. And our media needs to begin covering it this way before it's too late.
So in addition to listeners really pressuring the media to cover it this way, what else can they do on this issue? We have about 30 seconds.
You know, I think that there needs to be awareness of this. You know, I think that until all of us begin to talk about and understand that these questions of structural democracy issues are at the heart of why none of us get action on the policy changes we want to see, democracy issues are at the forefront and at the beginning of all of that.
David Daley is an independent journalist and author of Rat Effed, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count. And if you want to know more about gerrymandering, this book is a very important read. David, thank you for your work, and we'd love to have you back for a full show so we can talk more about Hoffler, the recent Supreme Court decision, and what we can expect in the near future on gerrymandering and the census.
Anytime. Always a pleasure.
All right. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for listening. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, Leah Cesarine, our intern. Thanks to David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.